Okay, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. So I will talk about atomistic modeling of multi-million nanostructures. Obviously, I have to make a lot of approximations, and I will talk about quite simple methods of like two large systems. So I have to apologize quantum mechanics for such simplicity. I will probably speak about methods you have already forgotten, and I have not learned yet. So. This work was initiated when I was a postdoc at NRC, and now I'm in Toruń, in Poland, and here is Girona, so it's also a nice Gothic city, and we have a university there, which is called Nicolaus Copernicus University, so it's the city where Nicolaus Copernicus was born. So I will talk about quantum dots, and there are many different kinds of quantum dots. One of them are this kind of nanocrystals, which actually chemists can obtain by different methods. They put chemical reactants into the solvent, they can stop reaction, and they get objects that are consisting of hundreds of thousands of atoms of different sizes, different shapes, like these beautiful things here. This is one kind of objects that we are interested in. The other kind of systems that are actually quantum dots defined by Gates, these are systems when on the top of the two-dimensional electron gas one puts metallic gates and applied some voltage, and these are things are obtained by photolithographic methods, and one can confine electrons there. And for example, measure transport properties. Yet on the kind of quantum dots, and this I will focus today, are self-assembled quantum dots or self-organized quantum dots, which are obtained in a process that is called Stransky-Krasnov transition. In this process, we have a substrate, we change in a molecular beam epitaxy chamber, we change the material from, for example, gallium arsenide to indium arsenide. And then, due to the strain relaxation, there's a growth of such ions, like we can hear in atomic force microscopy. Then everything is covered. And in the end, we have something like this. This is, for example, this is cross-section STM, so those points are actual atoms. Here is an island of indium arsenide surrounded by gallium arsenide. Here, then one can go further with this and produce such systems like double quantum dots, which align, self-align the strain. Or even multiple quantum dots, like in this picture. So they grow in a random places, but in recent years there's a significant progress in putting quantum dots on such nano ridges or nano templates. My computer. The project is Thank you. In recent years, there was a lot of effort in putting those randomly positioned objects into well-defined places, or on such nano-templates like this one from NRC. One can even put additional gates and try to tune quantum dot properties with external fields. There's plenty of potential applications in, for example, nano in light devices, in photovoltaics, in quantum information. Here we have some unlucky mouse, and with quantum dots shining, they are located close to the tumor, so in biomarkers or infrared devices and so on. There's a plenty of potential. And so, of course, we would like to model such systems, but as we heard a lot of talks before, we already have problems with small number of atoms. So, for example, if we had this many body, many electron Hamiltonian, we already have challenge with quite small systems, and we actually have thousands of atoms in our system. So what we could do, we have a lot of theoretical approaches with number of atoms going from left to right. So for example, some configuration interaction coupled clustered methods here on the left, or crude but effective, really effective, effective mass approach. And we are here nowadays, both in terms of the computational power, somewhere here. So what we are doing, actually, we are using tie binding method, which of course has a lot of disadvantages. So for example, if you had density functional approach that we could use, we would have those details between atoms. Now we have, let's say, atomistic resolution, but nothing more than this. So we are here in this regime. So why do we need atomistic modeling? Why we are not satisfied with effective masses? Because the singlet lattice that constitutes that the last quantum dots are built from, for those self-assembled quantum dots, it doesn't have inversion symmetry, and it has consequences on the emission spectra of such quantum dots, because there are things like strain effects due to the lattice mismatch of indium arsenide, gallium arsenide, because there are certain details of the emission spectra I will try to talk today that we think atomistic calculation is necessary for to describe. So this is our computational scheme. There is no self-consistency. It's quite simple, but there are quite large number of atoms. So we start with the modeling. When we take as an input size, shape, and composition, we take it from experiment. Then we do atomistic strain calculation, or you could also call it geometry optimization. And then we take those atomic positions and calculate single particle levels with atomistic tie binding model of the orbitals. Then we populate those orbitals with electrons and holes, because we are going to have electrons and holes, and we calculate many body properties using configuration interactions. Because we have those strain effects, and they are long range, we need to have a computational domain for strain calculation that reaches up to 100 million atoms. And because we have quantum dots surrounded by the material, the buffer material, we also need quite large computational domain for tie binding calculation. So the first step is the geometry definition. So for example, we have this kind of an input. We model it with a dome shape or lens shape quantum dot on a wetting layer. This is called wetting layer. Everything here is surrounded by a large amount of material, which you don't see, of a different kind of material, different material. So this is indium arsenide, and it's surrounded by a large computational domain of gallium arsenide. There are also other dots like this, so-called indium flash dots or flat systems like this. And if we want to do realistic calculations, sorry, it's at the bottom. We also have alloyed systems with, for example, here, a non-uniform gradient of one material inside the other. And actually, modeling of trying to address experiment is what we in the end want to do. So we analyze now. We work on different alloying levels, different compositions. Plenty of work actually being done here. So the next step, once the geometry is defined, we do strain calculation or geometry optimization. Why we have to do it? So we have our quantum dot is built of one material, is surrounded by the other material. There's a lattice mismatch of these two, Which means that this, for example, arsenic at the edge has two neighbors. One is from two are from gallium, for example, two are from indium, and we have to deal with that. We use valence force field model, in which we express the total elastic energy in terms of bond stretching terms and bond bending terms. And the only problem is here that we have quite large number of atoms, so we have to find a minimum of such function. And this is function of 200 million variables for such systems. So, but it can be done. We do it nowadays. Computers are quite fast, so it is doable. It's quite fast actually. So, for example, does it really matter? Yes, it matters if we have if we assume that we have those atomic positions being fixed. They would occupy these uniform positions here. I want to remind you that I'm not showing you the external box, the external numbers, the external atoms. And if we do this, what we call string relaxation or geometry optimization, it looks actually like this. So you can see that there are some deviations from this artificial position, some little bends, some little changes, but they are actually quite important for realistic modeling of quantum dot systems. So we have atomic positions, and then we calculate single particle levels. So our wave function is a linear combination of atomic orbitals, and the only approximation we make here, the most important thing I need to say here, that we assume that our basis is orthogonal. So we write a tight binding Hamiltonian in basis of these atomic orbitals. We actually have we model on the valence orbitals. So we take 1s, 3p, and 5p, an additional s star orbital. This is sometimes added in solid state physics because it increases the size of the basis and it enables for the better description of bulk conduction band. And we write Hamiltonian in this basis here. It's written in the such a second quantization picture, but it actually is quite simple. Here we have on-site diagonal matrix elements and off-site off-diagonal matrix element, hopping matrix elements, and also matrix elements that are related to spin orbit interaction. And actually, spin orbit interaction is very important in modeling of quantum dots. If we neglect spin orbit interaction, we cannot hope for a realistic description of emission spectra. So we have a nearest neighbors approximation with four nearest neighbors. Each atom has 20 orbitals or spin orbitals with spin. And what we do, what is important to mention here, we don't calculate matrix elements. This is semi-empirical method, empirical type binding scheme, where we take those parameters by fitting to bulk properties. So just few remarks how we do it. It's from work by Slater and Koster from 50s. If we have, for example, tight binding matrix elements coupling s orbital on anion and pz orbital on cation, it is expressed in terms of this direction cosine and some integral. And actually, there are the Slater Koster rules taken from the paper from 1954. There's plenty of them, but they are very important because they reduce this large number of hopping matrix elements. 100 actually with 10 orbitals to 20 different integrals that are actually subject for fitting. So we fit to bulk, or we fit to different points of the Brillouin zone, not only the gamma point. We fit to effective masses, we fit to the curvatures of bands, so these are effective masses. We fit to gaps. Because we fit to the experimental gaps, we don't have problem with gap. Next, what we have to do, because this is fitting for equilibrium bulk, we have to treat somehow this strange situation when we have different bond lengths and angles. And we use so-called Harrison law, which is a power-like law for the changes of this of the hopping integrals. And also because of the Slater-Koster rules, we have any changes in angles even for free. So this ethos, these parameters are actually also empirical parameters, and we have to somehow find them. So just before I'll tell you how we do it, I'll show you, I'll just sum up how we fit, how we couple string into tie binding model. So there are several terms. First of all, the changes in hoppings in bond angles are given by Slater-Koster formalism. The changes in bond lengths are given by this Harrison law. And also there's a change of diagonal matrix elements. We can call it due to Christoff Hill, due to rearrangements of neighbors or due, or we could try to guess that this is because we have orthogonal tie binding method. And if we change positions of atoms, we would have to reorthogonalize our bases. So this gives us some changes to the diagonal matrix elements. So we fit our tie binding Hamiltonian to reproduce strain as given by hydrostatic. So two kinds of strain are the most important quantum dots. One is hydrostatic strain, which is basically simple compression. And so we fit to reproduce this the deformation potentials, and also there's a biaxial strain that we take actually from the EFT model. So we are able to quite well reproduce the evolution of conduction band, heavy holes and light holes with respect with under external strain. So there are several other existing parameterizations. They are used in different disciplines of physics. They have different advantages and disadvantages, quite similar to what we do. And so this is like single particle bias. Of course, when we have our Hamiltonian, we apply it to the finite domain, computational domain. So we have problems with edges due to the existence of dangling bonds. So we have a surface passivation scheme. I don't have the time to talk about it, but basically if we don't employ such a scheme, we are not able to distinguish states that are confined within the dot from the surface state that we are not interested in. So we have a way of decoupling the surface from the confined states, which are localized in quantum dots. Now we have single particle levels, and we are going to populate those single particle levels with electrons and holes. And before I will go to electron and hole Hamiltonian, I will show you some simplified picture. So this is a Polish beer called Żywiec. So this is a picture of a quantum dot in a ground state when we have fully occupied valence band and empty conduction band with this forbidden energy gap, and then there'll be excitation. So we have some process that will take one of these bottles here, and we have an excited an electron system. So instead of talking of such an electron system, we can talk of electron and hole, and an electron hole pair called exciton, and that they interact with, they are neutral all together, but they interact and through via Coulomb interaction. So they also, we can in this picture of glasses and bottles, we can talk about spin. This is actually because we have spin orbit interaction. This is quasi spin for electron and for hole. And because we have many possible places where we can place the bottle or the glass, and many possible pseudo spin orientations up and down. This gives us a lot of configuration, so we have to employ some configuration interaction scheme. And this is one exciton, one electron hole pair, but actually in experiment people observe many more interesting objects, like bi-excitons, or a negatively charged exciton, or positively charged exciton, which is two holes and one electron, and it is actually seen in experiments, so it's not a very exotic system. Or multi-excitonic systems with three or four or five, even more excitons. And so, of course, we have plenty of configurations that we need to take account. So we go from this many electron, Hamiltonian describing many electron system to Hamiltonian of electrons with single particle electron and single particle holes energies, and terms describing electron-electron interaction, a hole-hole interaction, and electron hole direct exchange interaction and so-called electron and electron-electron exchange interaction. And I'm not going to go into details, but this last term plays a recently important role in this area. So I'm going to talk a little bit about it later. So this is a summary. We also need to calculate dipole matrix elements because we are interested in emission spectra that we calculate using the Fermi-Golden rule, and I will show you later a little bit later some results. With this matrix elements, we have to calculate these matrix elements. So we take our single particle wave function given as a linear combination of atomic orbitals, and of course we have to make a lot of crude approximations. So we work on testing which of them are more and less important, but basically we write our matrix elements, Coulomb matrix elements, in terms of this double sum over all atoms and all, so this is n square like term with a simple bulk like screening condition, and on-site terms where we put, because we don't define our basis, we only assume it has certain symmetries sp and so on, it's orthogonal, so we here put for some Slater orbitals. I mean, there are many possible choices, but it seems like the choice of the basis here is not that relevant. We also have to calculate the dipole matrix elements. As I said, there's a lot of approximations here, but maybe it's not that interesting to talk about. So there's plenty of numerical problems we have to solve. We have this nice computer with 40 nodes. Each node is 8 cores. It's 320 cores. It's relatively cheap, but it's not that easy to write programs on, because we have to write MPI applications. And actually we have three-dimensional lattice, not two-dimensional lattice, that we need to divide between different computers. And so we have equal workload on each of the computers or cores. We have minimal communication, so atom from here only communicates, so CPU-1 only communicates with CPU-2. And there was plenty of different algorithms we developed. We have parallel Lanczos, parallel conjugate for the diagonalization, parallel conjugate gradient for the force field calculation. We have actually parallel fitting algorithms, genetic algorithms, and plenty of other. I think it's altogether 10 different codes that were actually written from scratch. Probably we could do some existing codes, but we didn't know about them. So now some results. I write here nominally cylindrical dots because this is an example of a quantum dot. I want to remind you it's surrounded by bulk material. It's not very large. It's actually one of the smaller ones, and it's flat. Sorry about that again. So the computational domain for the valence force field is 32 million atoms. For tight binding, it's 1/3 of 1 million. And I'm going to show you some results of the tight binding calculation. So here are single particle electron status. So those levels that are unoccupied that correspond to conduction band, the ground electron state is of S character. Then we have two nearly degenerate P states, not three, because this is flat system. This is flat system with two-dimensional like confinement. And 3D like states. This is actually very similar to effective mass model with harmonic like confinement with two harmonic like oscillators. So for modelic electron states, we probably don't need atomistic calculation. Now holes are also quite similar, yet a little bit different with some small splittings. Now, if we take a different dot, tall dot like this, with something that looks more like parabolic confinement, it's tall, it's a dome-shaped system, and we look at electron states, they are actually very similar. This harmonic oscillator model would work here very beautifully, but there is a very different structure of hole levels. And this structure of hole levels does not resemble what we expect from simple effectiveness calculation. And what we can do with our code, we can just take different layers. Here we take 1 nanometer slices. We actually can take monolayers. And we look at the electron states. So this is this ground electron states. There is really not much changes here. And we look at the whole states. And there is a dramatic change. For example, from 2 to 4 nanometers, the character of the ground hole state from this S-like type changes to P-type. And this is related to all the strain effects and many, many, many complicated things. Maybe not complicated things, but many things that one has, that it's easy to overlook in effective mass approximation. Now, this is yet another lens type quantum dot. So this before was a single particle calculation. And this is a dot that we call benchmark dot because people from Alex Zünger empirical pseudopotentials group, they often use this particular system for their calculation. Now we look at single particle levels. Again, for electrons, we have this nice picture. And for holes, a little bit more complicated, but also with this P-like type orbitals. And now we are going to take a look at many body properties. So we are going to add, we are going to populate these levels with electrons and these levels with holes. And so with increasing number of electron hole pairs with excitons, we start to populate this S shell pair. So here we have electron and hole. Here we have 2 electrons and 2 holes. There's a small shift towards lower energy. This is called bi-exciton binding energy. It's actually observed in experiment. Then we start to populate P shell and D shell and so on. And actually this kind of spectra you will see in experiment. I don't have a comparison here. Similarly, we have 1 exciton absorption spectra with these peaks coming from S shell and P shell. Absorption. Now, in emission spectra, when we have the emission spectra is following. If we have, for example, 4 exciton system, that is recombined to 3 exciton system, which means that we have 1 electron hole pair that is recombining in presence of 3 other excitons, and again we see this shell-like structure. You can notice here the energy scale. This is of the order of electron volts. And what we are interested in particular are details of this line. And I'm going to show you the so-called exciton fine structure, which recently is very important because there are schemes of generating electron entangled photon pairs from quantum dots. And this entangled photon pair generation scheme, they base on the structure of, they are, I will show what I want to say. So we have this emission, a recombination of electron hole pair, which is either we can look in this electron, all electron picture or electron hole picture. And actually there are different possibilities of the bottle or electron and hole spins. 2 of them gives us bright line, so this is transition that is enabled by the selection rules, and 2 of them are forbidden. And what we would like to have in entangled photon generation scheme is what we would like to have these 2 bright lines to be degenerate in terms of energy. And actually, it happens in experiment that there's a splitting of these 2 lines. So instead of having 2 lines of the same energy and 2 circular sigma plus sigma minus polarization, we have 2 lines that are polarized along some perpendicular directions with the linear polarization. And this was not understood in details for quite a time because people from effective mass approximation, once sees that if the dot is cylindrical, it is not possible. The dot has to be elongated somehow. But our system is only nominally cylindrical. I will switch back here. Because the shape is symmetrical, but the underlying lattice is not. It doesn't have, it has lower symmetry. So the overall symmetry of the system, which is the symmetry of the shape, but also of the singlet lattice, and for this system is C2V symmetry, and it results, it gives us this splitting, and we can model it, and we have quite good agreement of experiments, so that is two dark lines and two bright lines. The splitting between them is a regular electron-hole exchange, and this splitting between these two bright lines, polarized along two different crystal directions, used to was called anisotropic electron-hole exchange splitting, and now people start to talk about fine structure splitting because we know that there is no need for an asymmetry of the dot shape to give us that splitting. So, so we can model systems. We can try. We are moving towards agreement of experiment. There's a lot of work ahead of us, but I try to show you two examples. One example was that we have this black dot and we have harmonic oscillator light spectrum, and this is already seen in experiment. And another thing is that we have agreement with experiment is that this splitting of two bright lines and is also something that we can see and we can understand why. So thank you very much. The generic algorithm. The generic algorithm is only used in fitting bulk structure to tight binding Hamiltonian. So in tight binding Hamiltonian we have for example 20 or something parameters without strain and 20 strain related parameters. So we fit them with some constraints. So the bulk structure given by tight binding Hamiltonian gives us matches what we want to match. So this is what is generic algorithm is used for. The first question was about...
I think I've lost my idea.
Yeah.
when you were looking at an alloy...
Okay, about alloying. Alloying is...
It was the important thing. How do you allow for surface segregation?
Well, the point is that one could try to model alloying using some kinetic Monte Carlo methods, but it doesn't seem to work. So what we try to do, what people try to do, we take some models that are based on some other simulation or by experimental input. And of course there's a plenty of work here because there are different alloying profile, different polarization. There's a lot of work here. And as far as, I don't understand the third question.
So you've got your picture of the drop test. Uh-huh. I'm interested in the very first structure, the first layer that you've laid down.
You mean here?
So if you look at, and so I'm looking at the very first few, what's the structure of the very first few layers?
Those layers, you mean?
Droplet.
Here? Or you mean, this is called wetting layer.
The very first few wetting layers.
What is that?
Don't worry, I'll talk to you later.
Is something that has to be added to, if you want to model your, this is something that's always present in experiment.
Yeah,
This is a precursor of the growth.
Well, yes, exactly. My question I'm really interested in is in the effects of lattice mismatch in the very first few layers. I have some views on that, which is a bit unconventional. We can discuss
it later. It's actually very important because below that there is a material of a different lattice constant.
There's a huge
jump of all the electronic properties of the bond lengths and everything.
Well, there's another question.
I just wondered, stochastic integrals or Monte Carlo simulation, are they to that all of these systems? It's kind of a huge system, and Feynman approach is much effective in this kind of. Have you seen some works in the field of stochastic integrals in such quantum dots?
Not really. The only methodology that somehow addresses similar question is, as I mentioned before, empirical pseudo-potential methodology by Alex Universal and his group. I can tell you what would be the challenges, for example, for DFT to address such systems. One of these challenges would be to model gap correctly, and the other would be to model spin orbit interaction correctly. Because it's a necessity to use spin orbit direction here. If you don't use it, you will have very incorrect structure of whole levels. I'm pretty sure that there will be a lot of methods in the short future or 5-10 years, but I don't know about all the methods.
From past.
About methods from past, maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen anything.
Yeah,
there was a question. What was the necessity and how did you at the end decide about the epsilon you used in the Coulombic interaction? Because at the end, your inside connections are just cancelling out, so you have just treated the active connection. So probably, I would need the necessity just for the epsilon. What was the necessity?
Well, what happens is that you talk about the dielectric screening,
yes?
So this is a big issue if one wants to, for example, model those nanocrystals that I showed before. It's probably the way we use it is not sufficient. We just take bulk value because for already few nanometers, or actually the next nearest neighbors level, the screening seems to be already at the bulk level. So we take the one from the indium arsenide, so the one from the dot, and also because almost entirely the wave function is confined within the dot, so it seems like when we take the dot material, the electric screening, it works. It works in terms of comparison with different methodology. It works in comparison with experiments to some degree. If it's fully correct, I cannot answer that. We can try to put there some other formulas, like Ohm formula. As I say, it's a crude approximation.
Will not fit with epsilon 1?
No, certainly not. No. It would rescale Coulomb interaction by factor to a such degree that we would know from comparison to experiment it's wrong. It's actually quite high number. It's of the order of 10. The screening there is 10. And it's dominated by this long-range Coulomb screen.
Right. At this point, I suggest that we thank all our speakers of today's class.